It was a large, sprawling complex of buildings with wide verandas, whitewashed and iron-roofed, standing in a grove of dark-foliaged casa flora trees, from which the bats screeched and fluttered to dive upon the insects that swarmed in the light from the windows of the main building. Vicky halted the car in front of the largest building and found herself surrounded by silent but watchful throngs of dark men, all of them heavily armed, like the Harari she knew. But these were a different people. She didn't know why, but she was sure of it. There were many others camped in the grove. She could see their fires and hear the stamp and snort of their tethered horses, the voices of the women and the laughter of the men. The throng opened for her, and she crossed the veranda and entered the large room, which was crowded with many men, and lit by the smoky paraffin lamps that hung from the ceiling. The room stank of male sweat, tobacco, and the hot, spicy aroma of food and tej. A hostile silence fell as she entered, and Vicky stood uncertainly in the threshold, scrutinized by 100 dark, suspicious eyes, until Lige Mikhail rose from where he sat at the far end of the room. "Miss Camberwell," he took her hand, "I was beginning to worry about you. Did you send your dispatch?" He led her across the room and seated her beside him, before he indicated the man who sat opposite him. "This is Ras Kula of the Galas," he said. And despite her weariness, Vicky studied him with interest. Her first impression was identical to that she'd received from the men amongst the Casa Flora trees outside in the darkness. There was a veiled hostility, a coldness of the spirit about the man, an almost reptilian aura about the dark, unblinking eyes. He was a young man, still in his 20s, but his face and body were bloated by disease or debauchery, so that there was a soft, jelly-like look to his flesh. The skin was a pale, creamy colour, unhealthy and clammy, as though it had never been exposed to sunlight. His lips were full and petulant, a startling cherry red in colour that ill-suited the pale tones of his skin. He watched Vicky, when the prince introduced her, with the same dead expression in his eyes, but gave no acknowledgement. Though the flat, snake-like eyes moved slowly over her body, like loathsome hands, dwelling and lingering on her breasts and her legs, before moving back to Lige Mikhail's face. The pudgy, swollen hands lifted a buckhorn pipe to the dark cherry lips, and Ras Kula drew deeply upon it, holding the smoke in his lungs before exhaling slowly. When Vicky smelled the smoke, she knew the reason for the dead eyes and the Ras's puffy face. "You have not eaten all day," said Lige Mikhail, and gave instructions for food to be brought to Vicky. "You will excuse me now, Miss Camberwell. The Ras speaks no English, and our negotiations are still at an early stage. I have ordered a room made ready, where you may rest as soon as we have eaten. We shall be talking all the night." The Lige smiled briefly. "And saying very little. For a blood feud of 100 years is what we are talking around." He turned back to the Ras. The hot, spicy food warmed and filled the cold, hollow place in the pit of Vicky's stomach, and a mug of fiery tej made her choke and gasp, but then lifted her spirits and revived her journalist's curiosity, so that she could look again with interest at what was happening around her. The interminable discussions went on between the two men, cautious, plodding negotiations between implacable enemies, reluctantly drawn together by a greater danger and a more powerful adversary. On either side of Ras Kula sat two young Gala women, pale, slow-eyed creatures, with noble, regular features and thick, dark hair, frizzled out into a stiff, round bush that caught the light of the lanterns and glowed along the periphery like a luminous halo. They sat impassively, showing no emotion, even when the Ras fondled one or the other of them with the absent-minded caress that he might have bestowed on a lapdog. Only once, as he took a fat, round breast in one plump, soft paw and squeezed it, the girl winced slightly, and Vicky, seeing the crimson linen of her blouse, dampened in a wet, dark patch at the nipple, realized that the girl's breast was heavy with milk. Vicky's artificial sense of well-being was fast fading now, sinking once again under the weight of her weariness, and lulled by the food in her belly. The thick, smoky atmosphere and the hypnotic cadence of the Amharic language. She was on the point of excusing herself from the lidge and leaving, when there was a disturbance outside the room, and the shrill, angry cries of a voice, creaking with age and indignation. The room was immediately electric, with a charged feeling of expectation, and Ras Kula looked up and called out querulously. A youth of perhaps 19 years of age was dragged into the room and held by two armed guards in the centre of the hastily cleared space before Ras Kula. His arms were bound with rawhide that cut deeply into the flesh of his wrists, and his face was wet and shiny with the sweat of fear, while his eyes rolled wildly in their sockets. He was followed by a shrieking crone, a wizened, baboon-like figure, swathed in a voluminous black chamois, stiff with filth and greenish with age. Repeatedly, as she attempted to attack the captive youth, clawing at his face with bony, hooked fingers, her toothless old mouth opened in a dark, pink-lined pit, as she leapt and cavorted before the terrified youth, trying again and again to reach him, while the two guards pushed her away with cheerful guffaws and playful blows, never relinquishing their grip on their prisoner. The Ras leaned forward to watch this play with sudden awakening interest, his dark, dull eyes taking on a sparkle of anticipation as he asked a question, and the crone flew to him and flung herself full length before him. She began to bleat out a long, high-pitched plea, attempting at the same time to grasp and kiss the Ras's feet. The Ras giggled with anticipation, kicking away the old woman's hands, and occasionally asking a question that was answered either by the guards or the grovelling crone. "Miss Camberwell," whispered the prince, "I suggest that you leave now. This will not be pleasant to watch." "What is it?" Vicky demanded, her professional instincts roused. "What are they doing?" "The woman accuses the youth of murdering her son. The guards are her witness, and the Ras is trying the case. He will give judgment in a moment, and the sentence will be carried out immediately." "Here?" Vicky looked startled. "Yes, Miss Camberwell, I urge you to leave. The punishment will be biblical, from the Old Testament, which is the centre of the Coptic faith. It will be a tooth for a tooth." Vicky hesitated to take the prince's advice. All human experience was her field, no matter how bizarre. And suddenly it was too late. Laughingly, the Ras thrust the old woman away again, with a kick to the chest that sent her sprawling across the beaten earth floor, and he called a peremptory command to the guards who held the accused youth. Flapping like a maimed black crow upon the floor, the crone set up a wailing shriek of triumph as she heard the verdict, and she tried to regain her feet. The guards guffawed again and began to strip away the condemned man's clothing, tearing it from his body until he stood completely naked, except for his bonds. The crowded room now buzzed with excitement at the coming entertainment, and the doorway and windows were packed with those who had come in from the encampment across the Casa Flora trees. Even the two impressive Madonnas who flanked the Ras had become animated, leaning forward to chatter softly to each other, smiling secretly, as their dark moon eyes shone and the full swollen breasts swung heavily under the thin material of their blouses. The doomed youth was whimpering softly, his head turning back and forth as though seeking escape, his naked body slim and finely muscled, with dark amber skin that glowed in the lamplight, and his arms bound tightly behind his back. His legs were long, and the muscles looked hard and beautifully sculptured, and the dark bush of curls in his groin was dense and crisp-looking. His thick, circumcised penis hung limply, seeming to epitomize the man's despair. Vicky tried to tear her eyes away, ashamed to look upon a human being stripped thus of all dignity, but the spectacle was mesmeric. The old woman hopped and flapped in front of the captive, her wrinkled brown features contorted in an expression of utter malice, and she opened her toothless mouth and spat into his face. The spittle ran down his cheek and dripped onto his chest. "Please, leave now," Lijmikhal urged Vicky, and she tried to rise, but it seemed that her legs would not respond. One of the Gala warriors, sitting opposite Vicky, drew the narrow-bladed dagger from the tooled leather sheath on his hip. The handle was carved from the horn of a kudu bull and bound with copper wire. The blade was slightly curved and viciously pointed, twice the span of a man's hand in length. He shouted to attract the woman's attention, then sent the weapon skidding across the floor towards her. And she pounced upon it with another gleeful shriek and pranced before the cringing youth, brandishing the knife while the watchers shouted encouragement to her. The captive began to twist and struggle, watching the knife with the fixed concentration of despair and terror, but the two tall guards held him easily, chuckling like a pair of gaunt ogres, watching the knife also. The old woman let out one more high-pitched shriek and leapt at him. The long, skinny black arm lunged out, the point of the blade aimed at his heart. The woman's strength was too frail to drive it home, and the point struck bone and glanced aside, skidding around the ribcage, opening a long, shallow cut that exposed the white bone in its depths for the instant before blood flowed out between the lips of the wound. A howl of delight went up from the assembled Gallas, and they goaded on the Avenger with mocking eyes and yips like those of a pack of excited jackals. Again and again the old woman struck, and the youth kicked and struggled, his guards roaring with laughter, and the blood from the shallow wounds flying and sparkling in the lamplight, splattering the old woman's knife arm and speckling her angry, screeching face. Her frustration made her blows more wild and feeble. Unable to penetrate the chest, she turned her attack upon his face. One blow split his nose and upper lip, the next slashed across his eye, turning the socket instantly into a dark, blood-gutted hole. The guards let him fall to the floor. The old woman leapt upon his chest and, clinging to him like a huge, grotesque vampire bat, she began to saw determinedly at the youth's throat until at last the cartoid artery was erupted, dousing her robes and puddling the floor on which they rolled together, while the Gala watchers roared their approbation. Only then could Vicky move. She leapt to her feet and pushed her way through the throng that jammed the doorway and ran out into the cool night. She realized that her blouse was damp with the sweat of nausea, and she leaned against the stem of a Casa Flora tree, trying to fight it unavailingly. Then she doubled over and retched, tearingly, choking up her horror. The horror stayed with her for many hours, denying her the sleep her body craved. She lay alone in the small room that Lijmikhal had ordered for her, and listened to the drums beating and the shouts of laughter and bursts of singing from the Gala encampment among the Casa Flora trees. When she slept at last, it was not for long, and then she awoke to a soft tickling movement on her skin and the first fiery itch across her belly. Disgusted by the loathsome touch, she threw aside the single blanket and lit the candle. Across the flat, smooth plain of her belly, the bites of vermin were strung like a girdle of angry red beads, and she shuddered, her whole body crawling with the thought of it. She spent what remained of the night huddled uncomfortably on the floor of the armored car. The mountain cold struck through the steel of Miss Wobbly's hull, and Vicky shivered into the dawn, scratching morosely at the hot lumps across her stomach. Then she filled the growing ache of her empty stomach with a tin of cold corned beef from the emergency rations in the locker under the driver's seat before driving up the slope of the Western Pass to the German mission station, where she experienced the first lift of spirits since the horrors of the night. Sarah had responded almost miraculously to the treatment she was receiving, and although she was still weak and a little shaky, the fever had abated, and she was once more able to give Vicky the benefit of her vast wisdom and worldly experience. Vicky sat beside the narrow iron bedstead in the overcrowded ward while the other patients coughed and groaned around her and held Sarah's thin, dry hand, from which the flesh seemed to have wasted overnight, and poured out to her the horrors still pent up inside her. Rascula! Sarah made a moo of disgust. He is a degenerate man, that one. Did he have his milch cars with him? Vicky was for a moment at a loss, then she remembered the two Madonnas. His men scour the mountains to keep him supplied with pretty young mothers in full milk. Ugh! She shuddered theatrically, and Vicky felt her unsettled stomach quail. That and his hemp pipe, and the sight of blood. He is an animal. His people are animals. They have been our enemies since the time of Solomon. And it shames me now that we must have them to fight beside us. Then she changed the subject in her usual mercurial fashion. Will you go down to the pass today? Yes, Vicky said, and Sarah sighed.
The doctor says that I cannot go with you.
Not for many days still. I'll fetch you as soon as you're ready.
No, no, she protested. It is shorter and easier on horseback, and I will come immediately. But until then, carry my love to Gregorius. Tell him my heart beats with great fury for him, and he walks through my thoughts eternally.
I'll tell him, agreed Vicky, delighted at the sentiment and the choice of words. At that moment, a tall young man in a white jacket, with the face of a brown pharaoh and huge dark eyes, came to record Sarah's temperature, stooping solicitously over her and murmuring softly in Amharic as he felt for her pulse with delicate, finely shaped hands. Sarah was transformed instantly into a languid wanton, with smouldering eyes and pouting lips, but when the orderly left, she was instantly herself again, giggling delightedly as she drew Vicky's head down to whisper in her ear.
"Is he not as beautiful as the dawn? He studies to be a doctor, and goes soon to the university at Berlin. He has fallen in love with me since last night, and as soon as my leg is less painful, I shall take him as a lover."
And when she saw Vicky's startled glance, she went on hurriedly,
"But just for a short time, of course, only until I am well enough to ride back to Gregorius."
Then Lige Mikhail came, riding with his wild horsemen. They waited outside in the sun while the prince came into the ward to take farewell of his daughter. His sombre mood lightened momentarily as he embraced Sarah, and he saw how well she had recovered. Then he told the two women, "Yesterday at noon, the Italian army, under General De Bono, crossed the Mareb River in force and has begun to march on Adowa and Ambar Aradam. The wolf is in the sheepfold. There has already been fighting, and the Italian aeroplanes are bombing our towns. We are now at war."
"It is no surprise," said Sarah. "The only surprise is that they took so long."
"Miss Camberwell, you must return as swiftly as you can to my father at the foot of the gorge, and warn him that he must be ready to meet an enemy attack."
He drew a gold pocket watch and glanced at it.
"Within the next few minutes, an aircraft will be landing here to take me to the Emperor. I would be obliged, Mr. Camberwell, if you would accompany me to the landing field."
Vicky nodded, and the Lige went on.
"Rascula's men are assembled there. He has agreed to send 1,500 horsemen to join my father, and they will follow you."
He got no further, for Sarah intervened hotly.
"Miss Camberwell will not be left alone with those hyenas of Kula's. They would eat their own mothers."
The Lige smiled and held up a hand.
"My own bodyguard will ride with Miss Camberwell under my strict charge to protect her at all times."
"I do not like it,"
pouted Sarah, and groped for Vicky's hand.
"I'll be all right, Sarah."
She stooped and kissed the girl, who clung to her for an instant.
"I will come soon," whispered Sarah. "Do nothing until I am with you."
"Perhaps it should be Gareth after all."
And Vicky chuckled.
"You're getting me confused."
"Yes," agreed Sarah. "That is why I should be there to advise you."
Lige Mikhail and Vicky stood side by side on the hull of Miss Wobbly and shaded the sun from their eyes as they watched the aircraft come in between the peaks.
As a pilot, Vicky could appreciate the difficulty of the approach down into the bowl of Sardi, where treacherous downdrafts fell along the cliffs, creating whirlpools of turbulence. The sun had already dispelled the chill of the night, making the high mountain air even thinner and more treacherous. Vicky recognized the aircraft type immediately, for she'd trained for her own pilot's license on a similar model. It was a Pussmoth, a small, sky-blue, high-winged monoplane, powered by the versatile de Havilland four-cylinder aero engine. It would carry a pilot and two passengers in a tricycle arrangement of seating, the pilot up front in an enclosed cabin under the broad sweep of the wings. Seeing the familiar aircraft reminded her with a fleeting but bitter pang of those golden, untroubled days before October 1929, before that Black Friday of evil reputation. Those idyllic days, when she'd been the only daughter of a rich man, spoilt and pampered, plied with such toys as motor cars and speedboats and aircraft. All that had been swept away in a single day. Everything had gone. Even that adoring, godlike figure that had been her father, dead by his own hand. She felt the chill of it still, the sense of terrible loss, and she turned her thoughts aside and concentrated on the approaching aircraft. The pilot came in down the western pass, under the cliffs, then turned steeply and sideslipped in towards the only piece of open ground in the valley that was free of rocks and holes. It was used as a stockyard, gymkhana ground or polo field as the need arose, and at the moment the ankle-deep grass was providing grazing for 50 goats. Ras Kula's horsemen drove the goats from the field at a gallop, and then, as the Pussmoth touched down, they wheeled and tore down the field at its wingtips, firing their rifles into the air and vying with each other to perform feats of horsemanship. The pilot taxied to where the car stood and opened the side window. He was a burly young white man, with a sun-tanned face and curly hair. He shouted above the engine rumble in an indeterminate colonial accent. Australian, New Zealand, or South African? "Are you Lidge Mikhail?" The prince shook hands briefly with Vicky before jumping down. With his chamois fluttering wildly in the slipstream from the propeller, he hurried to the aircraft and climbed into the tiny cabin. The pilot was watching Vicky with a lively interest through the side window, and when she caught his eye, he pursed his lips and made a circle with thumb and forefinger in the universal sign of approval. His grin was so frank and boyishly open that Vicky had to grin back. "Room for one more," he shouted, and she laughed and shouted back. "Next time, perhaps." "Be a pleasure, lady." And he gunned the motor and swung away, lining up on the short, rough, surfaced runway. Vicky watched the Pussmoth climb laboriously up towards the mountain crests. As the busy buzzing of its engine faded, a feeling of terrible loneliness fell over her, and she glanced round apprehensively at the hordes of swarthy horsemen who surrounded the armoured car. Suddenly she realized that not one of all these men could speak her language, and that now there was a small, cold cramp of fear at the base of her belly to go with the aloneness. Almost desperately, she longed for some contact with the world which she knew, rather than these strange horsemen in this land of wild mountains. For an instant, she thought of checking the telegraph office for a reply to her dispatch, but dismissed the idea immediately. There was no chance that her editor would yet have received it, let alone replied to her communication. Now she looked around her and identified the knot of men and horses that comprised Lidge Mikhail's bodyguard. But they seemed very little different from the greater mass of Gallus. Little comfort there. And she climbed quickly down into the driver's hatch of the car and engaged the low gear. She bumped over the rough ground and found the track that led down along the river towards the tall grey stone portals of the gorge. She was aware of the long, untidy column of mounted men that followed her closely, but her mind leapt ahead, to her arrival at the foot of the gorge, to her reunion with Jake and Gareth. Suddenly, those two were the most important persons in her whole existence,
And she longed for them, both or either of them, with a strength that showed in the white knuckles of her hands as she gripped the steering wheel. The descent of the gorge was a more terrifying experience than the ascent. The steeper stretches fell away before Vicky with the gut-swooping feel of a ski run, and once the heavy, cumbersome car was committed to it, its own weight took charge and it went down bucking and skidding. Even with the brakes locking all four wheels, it kept plunging downwards, with very little steering control transmitted to the front wheels. A little after noon, Vicky had come more than halfway down the gorge, and she remembered that this final pitch was the truly terrifying part, where the track clung to the precipice, high above the roaring river in its rocky bed. Her arms and back were painfully cramped with the effort of fighting the kicking wheel, and sweat had drenched her hair at her temples and stung her eyes. She wiped it away with her forearm and went at the slope, braking hard the moment that the car began rolling down the 30-degree incline. With rock and loose earth kicking and spewing out from under the big wheels, they descended in a heavy, lumbering rush. And halfway down, Vicky realized that she had no control and that the vehicle was gradually slewing sideways and swinging its tail out towards the edge of the cliff. She felt the first lurch as one rear wheel dropped slightly, riding out over the 100-foot drop, and instinctively she knew that in this instant of its headlong career, the car was critically hanging at the extreme edge of its balance. In a hundredth of a second it would go beyond the point of recovery, and she made, without conscious thought, a last instinctive grasp at survival. She jumped her foot from the brake pedal, swung the wheel into the line of skid, and thrust her other foot down hard on the throttle. One wheel hung over the cliff, the other caught with a vicious jerk as the engine roared at full power, and the huge steel hull jumped like a startled gazelle and hurled itself away from the cliff edge, struck the far bank of earth and rocky scree, and was flung back miraculously into its original line of track. At the bottom of the pitch, the slope eased. Vicky fought the car to a standstill there and dragged herself out of the driver's hatch. She found that she was shaking uncontrollably and that she had to get to a private place off the track, for in reaction she was close to vomiting and her control of her other bodily functions was shaken by that terrible sliding, bucking ride. She'd left the column of horsemen far behind, and could only faintly hear their voices and clatter of hooves on the rocky track as she scrambled and clawed her way up the side of the gorge to a thicket of dwarf cedar trees where she could be alone. There was a spring of clear, sweet water among the cedars, and when her body had purged itself and she had it under control again, she knelt beside the rocky pool and bathed her face and neck. Using the surface of the shining water as a mirror, she combed her hair and rearranged her clothing. The reaction to extreme fear had left her feeling light-headed and slightly apart from reality. She picked her way out of the cedar thicket and down to where the car stood upon the track. The Gallo horsemen had arrived, and they and their mounts crowded the entire area, back up the track for half a mile, and in a solid mob about the armoured car. Those nearest the car had dismounted. When she tried to make her way through their ranks, they gave her only minimal passage, so that she must brush close to them. Suddenly she realized, with a fresh lunge of fear in her chest, that the Harari bodyguard of Lige MacHale was no longer with her, and she stopped uncertainly and looked about her, trying to find where they were. An aching silence had fallen on the gallows, and now she saw that their expressions were tense also. The faces, with their handsome, high-boned features and beaky noses, turned towards her with the predatory expectation of the hunting hawk. And the eyes burned with the same fierce excitement with which they had watched the old crone do her bloody work the previous night. The Harari. Where were the Harari? She looked about her wildly now, but could not find a familiar face. And then in the silence she heard the clatter of distant hooves from far down the gorge, and she knew without any shade of doubt that they'd left her. They'd been driven away by the threats of their ancient enemies, who outnumber them so heavily.
she was alone, and she turned to go back, but found that they'd closed about her, cutting off her retreat, and now they pressed gradually closer about her, with the same smouldering, gloating expression on every face.